KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. And the theme song of today's show, which was Richard Cheese's cover of Guns N' Roses' Welcome to the Jungle, is kind of an appropriate theme song for our topic of discussion today. Today, I'm really thrilled to have Professor Joanna Demers from University of Southern California on today's show to discuss her new book, Steal This Music, How Intellectual Property Law Affects Music Creativity, published by University of Georgia Press. The title of the book really indicates kind of where we are today, intellectual property law affecting musical creativity. For most people who simply listen to music, it may be counterintuitive or maybe something that you may not have too much familiarity with, but today, and especially given the technology that exists and the way that music is created, intellectual property law is an incredibly important, although many musicians would probably regret this, a very important element of the work that they do. Professor Demers has written an outstanding book tracing the history of, at least the modern history of music creation, and focusing on how this intellectual property law itself impacts the world in which we live when it comes to music creation. Professor Demers is an assistant professor of music history and literature at USC, where she teaches on 20th century concert and popular music. Her work has appeared in Popular Music and the Journal of Popular Music Studies. And interestingly, she is also a freelance forensic musicologist and consultant on musical copyright. I'm going to ask her a little bit about musicology and what that entails. For people that focus on these issues from a technological standpoint, it will come as no surprise that a book like this is needed, because there is so much to be said now about the interaction of technology and music creation and the law. And so I'm looking forward to what I think will be a pretty wide-ranging discussion with Professor Demers. So after another brief musical interlude, we will come back and talk to the professor. The classic collaboration between Run-DMC and Aerosmith, which created Walk This Way. So I am very pleased to welcome Professor Demers to the air. Are you there? Terrific. You have experienced the slings and arrows of my own engineering skills, so I want to thank you profusely for being here today and for discussing your outstanding book.
Thank you.
Let me start off by just offering the opportunity to kind of contextualize everything. Tell us a little bit about why the title and how you came to identify this area of study.
I wrote this book basically as an extension of a chapter from my PhD dissertation, which discussed sampling in hip-hop music. And rather than rewriting the whole dissertation and turning it into a book, what I decided to do was focus on the intellectual property law issues pertaining not only to hip-hop but to music at large, because I really think that that's what more people are interested in than perhaps the rigors of hip-hop aesthetics. The title came along because we're actually referring to Steal This Book, the countercultural book by Abby Hoffman. But I'm not really continuing with Abby Hoffman's meaning so much as referring to the fact that in music, what is often referred to as theft is really not theft or plagiarism at all, but rather an activity that I refer to as transformative appropriation, where musicians refer to other pieces of music, but in a sort of clever or collaborative or even critical way, where they take a tradition and sort of improve upon it.
The collaborative effort in creation of music is obviously something that seems to span back in time. I talked a little bit about your background, but I'm curious, writing a book that focuses so much on law, was it a challenge from a musicologist standpoint? And while I'm at it, for the benefit of the listeners, what is a musicologist?
That's a good question. I ask myself that all the time. Uh-huh. Musicologists are specialists in the history, interpretation, and criticism of music. It's a discipline that's a little over 100 years old, and We're the people who teach the classes on music appreciation in colleges, and for music majors, we'll go into greater depth about a particular composer or repertoire or era. So that's what musicologists do. The law aspect, oh boy. Boy, was it a challenge. I'm not a lawyer.
It's a tough thing for lawyers.
Yes. Yeah, I had to do a lot of grunt work. I was very fortunate to have some very generous people at the USC School of Law and at other law schools in the area who basically gratis gave me primers on intellectual property, referred me to books, explained it in sort of bonehead terms so even I could understand it, and I went from there.
It's one of those areas where, you know, as an attorney who's litigated this stuff, it's always a challenge to kind of see where the law's going. But let's talk a little bit about the law before I get into some of the details of your book. And, you know, even though I'm going to sound like someone that has a vested interest in your book, I own no stock in Georgia. We have no financial relationship otherwise, but I can say I thought the book was outstanding. Was there a time when intellectual property laws were simply irrelevant to music creation? You identify a period where there was less of a concern. But just for the benefit of kind of get a context of where we are, was it ever of no concern to people?
Oh, sure, definitely. Of course, intellectual property law really only began in earnest in the early modern period, so the 16th and 17th centuries. So anything before that, it was definitely a moot point. If someone wrote down a piece of music, it was never even considered for a moment that that person could control the music or could charge other people for performing it or even looking at it. The practice of actually writing your name on a piece of music that you've written is fairly new. During the Middle Ages, very few composers did that. And even the practice of writing music down, period, is new. Of course, you don't need to write music down in order for music to occur, and music basically until the modern era was more of an oral tradition anyway. When this started to change, when IP law started to become relevant to music, was right around the time that printing press technologies started to become used to print and distribute music. So again, in the early modern period, but there still was kind of a very flexible view towards musical creativity in that publishers were only concerned about distributing the music, and it was less important to them whether a composer listed on a piece of music actually wrote the piece indicated. Oftentimes, publishers would just choose the biggest name in the business and put his or her name on the piece of paper in order to drum up sales. So the ethics were, you know, a little looser back then. This became an issue, or rather intellectual property law really started to impact music when, in the 19th century, composers were starting to become bothered that, okay, sure, they could protect sales of their sheet music, but if someone wanted to come along and perform a piece of music of theirs, a composer was having a hard time getting any sort of payment or revenue from that. And so that's when the United States and several countries in Europe started developing really robust IP regimes. And then the final step in this is, of course, when sound recording began in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, and all of a sudden you had the capacity to distribute recordings of music independent of any sort of sheet music.
The nature of music creation being what it is, obviously technology impacts it. Again, to kind of frame the discussion before we get into some of the details, the introduction to your book, which was written by Rosemary Coombe at York University, discusses, and your book discusses in greater detail, the difference between transformative appropriation versus plagiarism and music piracy. This is a topic which, for anyone that's taking a look at issues of commons or even network neutrality, I mean, all of these kinds of issues that go to whether we're going to have a system that's regulated strictly by rights and by ownership, or whether we're going to have an intellectual property system, an internet, which allows for free exchange absent permission. Transformative appropriation versus plagiarism and music piracy, I think, fits into that realm. But for the benefit of the listener, can you define those terms in a little more detail and kind of give us a sense of what the difference is to a music creator and the public, and then finally the $64,000 question, content industry itself?
Sure. To begin with, piracy, that's pretty straightforward. It's when you take a protected work that's not your own and you decide to distribute it to multiple users. So you download a song and share it with 10,000 of your closest friends on the internet. Plagiarism would be if you take an original work and try to pass it off as your own without doing anything to it. So a classic example is a college student who downloads a term paper from the internet and then writes his or her name on it and turns it in. Transformative appropriation, I argue, and several other people would agree with me, is different from either of these activities, and it should be permitted under certain circumstances. What this is basically when any artist takes pre-existent work and perhaps excerpts it, abstracts it, refers to it, but does something that indicates his or her own original work. Anytime you have a cover song, for instance, the Richard Cheese cover song at the beginning of the program, that's an instance of transformative appropriation because he's taken the melody and the lyrics of the Guns N' Roses original, but he's kind of added a lot to it to the point where it becomes a musical joke.
And it's interesting because a lot of times, not to interrupt you, I think people think of this kind of transformation as being in the Weird Al Yankovic mold, but it's much broader than that, isn't it?
Sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, cover songs can be humorous, and some people don't think very highly of them, but sure, that's definitely protected under law, and everything is totally licit. There are other forms of transformative appropriation that are very prestigious. Everything in jazz, virtually, is a form of transformative appropriation, just taking the chord changes of a show tune taking a famous solo and riffing on it. These are all just the bread and butter of most musical traditions, and you wouldn't be able to write music without engaging in some form of it. So that having been said, you can probably imagine that musicians are going to be very pro-transformative appropriation for the most part, especially now given the internet and sort of remix culture and the prevalence of sampling. I think it's fair to say that most musicians perceive a very big chasm between transformative appropriation, which they support, and piracy and plagiarism, which many, although not all, would discourage. The public, thanks to efforts by people like Larry Lessig and Kemper McLeod and Siva Vidyanathan, I think the public is starting to become better educated about the role of transformative appropriation, not only in music, but in writing, in any other sort of artistic or humanistic activity. We need to be able to riff off of each other and refer to each other's works in order to create something new. So I'm more optimistic about the public's outlook on these three activities. Industry, I'm a little less bullish about. There are fits and starts of movements in major record labels to start to allow this sort of transformative appropriation, to allow certain artists to remix and only pay a nominal fee. But by and large, I think that's slow in coming. And the reason why is because by discouraging transformative appropriation, the music industry is really allowing, or rather ensuring, continued revenue flow.
The revenue flow element of this obviously is another huge factor, and since you brought it up, I kind of wanted to touch on it a little bit. You know, there's been the recent discussion over the pricing on iTunes and things like that, where you have situations where the 99-cent standard has been challenged, although most recently it seems like that's going to stay. But a lot of intellectual property law itself, and I think, the major focus of intellectual property law in terms of its purpose, in other words, why is it there, has been the general argument that it is needed to spur innovation, to capture the value. And again, I know you're not an attorney, so I want to, and I'm not going to burden you, despite the generous offerings of lawyers and professors to help you out on this. But I want to focus on what I think is the really fascinating underside to it, which is, what is your sense of why people today, as opposed to the past, are making these works? We have your book discusses mashups and these different kinds of internet creations that people are putting out there for free. And yet it seems, and correct me if I'm wrong, the law has gone so far as to regulate and prohibit that activity as well.
Right. Why is it happening now? Well, number one, because the technology is there that allows it. Keep in mind that prior to the internet, music making, and especially recording studio technology, was really in the hands of a privileged few. You had to have an enormous amount of money in order to buy a mixing console, for instance. And musicians who wanted to record sort of a professional quality recording or album had to, you know, in certain circumstances, take out mortgages or loans or something in order to pay for it. What the current internet era has allowed, in addition, obviously, to the internet, is all of a sudden a vast price reduction in things like home studio software and mixing equipment and that sort of thing, to the point that, you know, an amateur like me can basically produce a professional recording in my own living room. And when you do that, what you do is you encourage the public, which in the past had been a sort of passive recipient of music, to become an active participant. So this, of course, in tandem with things like YouTube and blogging, video blogging, that sort of thing. I think people, especially in younger age groups, are just much more accustomed to being active purveyors in creating content and in sharing and riffing off of each other.
And that does seem to be the case. And I think Jamie Boyle, the law professor at Duke, refers to law academics and legal academy members as using anecdata as opposed to something else. So my anecdata, based upon taking a look at YouTube and various mashups, as that seems to be the case. Let me get down to a little level of specifics here. Your book discusses, and we were talking about sampling and things like that, the Public Enemy litigation, where Public Enemy was, you know, one of the major purveyors of sampling, the idea of taking a song and using portions of it or what have you, was apparently shut down as a result of the current state of the law. Give us a sense of, based upon that litigation and others that you may identify, how these clamps on use have impacted music, and more specifically, for based upon your research, are musicians really not creating because of the law, or are they, as we're talking about, just simply being driven underground?
That's an excellent question. What happened very briefly is that hip-hop began in the sort of mid-70s as a genre of music that relied on reusing other recordings of a DJ taking several vinyl discs and playing them, isolating bits of them, and just kind of creating sonic collages. Fast forward to the mid-80s when hip-hop becomes a really national phenomenon. Even white kids in the suburbs want to listen to hip-hop music. And DJs are still at the point where they can sample or they can borrow other music largely with impunity. There are a few lawsuits that appear, but they're all settled out of court and nothing major happens. This changes in 1991 with a series of very dramatic lawsuits that all of a sudden put sampling or cast sampling as an illicit act. The most famous case is the Biz Markie case that basically ended Biz Markie's career as a rapper. It eventually settled, but not before the judge condemned Biz Markie as a thief and used biblical terminology to refer to sampling as an act of theft. And what this did was it sent a very clear message to the record industry that if they were going to release any subsequent recordings with samples, those samples had to be cleared and licenses had to be acquired ahead of time. And so you mentioned Public Enemy. The same sort of thing happened to Public Enemy, of course, but they were more resilient as a band, probably because they had a greater reputation and sort of customer base to begin with. But Public Enemy, of course, now is releasing music that doesn't sound anything like what they were releasing in the late 80s. And that's because, you know, they've said famously in interviews that the price of clearing the samples for only one of their songs released in the 80s would have exceeded all of the revenue for an entire album.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. So whether this is really forcing musicians not to create, obviously not, but what it is doing is alerting musicians to what they can get away with and what they can't. As you mentioned, some musicians just do this underground knowing that they're never going to sell enough units to be of any interest. Many musicians are actually kind of refining their sampling vocabulary, and they're sampling either smaller bits or sampling from obscure sources, thinking that no one would really care, no one would even recognize the sources. And other musicians are just not sampling from recognizable music. They're creating their own samples. And that's a perfectly legitimate and legal way around this whole problem.
It's amazing how the economics continue to intrude, because basically what the law has now created is a situation by which the decision as to whether something is legal is based entirely or mostly on whether A, someone cares enough monetarily to get involved, and B, whether the song will ultimately make any money in the first place. And that, you know, obviously that's not, it shouldn't be anyway, I don't think, where the law is going. Before we go into another short music break, I kind of want to, you know, continue on this issue of criminalization. Again, when, you know, taking a top-level view of things, whenever we criminalize activity that, you know, whether it's free speech or First Amendment or what have you, would suggest should not be criminal, you wind up basically, even if you're not prosecuting someone, basically telling them that what they're doing is wrong. And it seems like a major focus of your book and the works of others whom you discuss in your book is this criminalization of creation. Do you view your book as being in the forefront of a movement to change the public's views of IP law generally or of music creation? Or where do you, what would be your ultimate happy ending as a result of people reading this book?
Oh, the happy ending would be just that people become a little bit savvier about IP law in general. Maybe they're not musicians, maybe they don't have any vested interest in music, but they definitely should care about things like the Copyright Term Extension Act. And I think if we had had as much public awareness of these issues back in the late 90s, then perhaps we wouldn't have had the I would view as a disappointing conclusion by the Supreme Court regarding the Eldridge case. I'm very concerned that in another 50 or 70 or 100 years, Congress will be voting to further extend copyright durations. And that's something that I think every American should care about. Sure, it's not life and death, but we would not benefit as a technological power or an intellectual power by having perpetual copyrights, and I think that is a very real possibility if the public doesn't get involved and start writing letters to congressmen.
Well, that that clarion call, I think, is a good breaking point here to kind of pick up on that and see where the politics are of this stuff, and focus more on how music is created and where people should go. So when we come back from the music break, we'll continue the discussion. There's a prime example of what we can do in transformative works. That's Bad Plus doing a cover of Led Zeppelin's Immigrant Song. There's an example, Johnny, you were mentioning jazz transformative works. And, you know, I'm curious, again, getting back to the world of anecdata, What's your sense? What are people, is there a prevalent type of transformation that's occurring right now as a result of the technology? I mean, jazz has always had that kind of history of taking works and making new things out of them. But we're just out of curiosity, where are things headed right now?
Two directions are kind of interesting to me. One is not really musically creative at all, but it's just taking pre-existent works and mashing up videos to them. This is pretty much totally illegal. I can't find it within my heart to justify this in any way, but it sure is popular. If you go on YouTube, you'll see people taking their favorite song and mashing up video from films, anime, television, their own personal films, they take it home, you name it. And it's kind of a new way of consuming music. It's basically by looking at unusual images, you kind of recontextualize the song in your mind. And that's totally illegal.
How do you mean? I mean, I think there's certainly a round of debate as to the level of creativity and transformation there. But I'm curious, given the theme of your book, why you feel so strongly that that's an illegal activity?
When you take a song and you just basically use it as a soundtrack for your own personal video and you don't do anything to the song, you're using someone else's copyrighted music, right? And not that any of these videos are necessarily earning any money, but perhaps the owner of the copyright or the songwriter or the recording artist would want to have a say about how you use their work, that sort of thing. I don't want to get into that too much just because it, by and large, is pretty innocuous anyway.
Right, and again, I emphasize that I understand that you're not an attorney, and so I'm not going to engage in a legal debate on the issue, but I understand your point.
Sure. The second aspect, and this is really fun, I mentioned earlier that with home recording software, anyone can make something that sounds like it was recorded in Abbey Road Studios virtually. What this is allowing people to do is to make, one of the most prevalent types of music that's made with this sort of software is electronic dance music. And what you need for that is a good steady beat, and beats aren't copyrightable, so that's your foundation. And then you can just purchase sample libraries online of different types of sounds that have already been pre-cleared, so you're not risking any sort of lawsuit. And you can put these sounds together kind of in a jigsaw puzzle type arrangement, just putting things together however you see fit. And you can create music that way. It is enormously popular among young people, you know, teenagers, early 20s, that sort of thing. And some of it's good, some of it is not ready for prime time, but it's as popular as listening to music is now. That's kind of the realization I had to undergo in the past several months, is that music consumption and music creation are really now occupying more of the same space for younger people.
That kind of touches on another interesting point in your book that I wanted to get into, which is the idea of the lone genius. Just quoting from your book, although whenever I quote a sentence from a book, I always want to say that you should read the whole book. But the sentence I'm going to quote is, on page 28 of your book, where you say, "The ideal of the author as a lone genius contradicts the fact that transformative appropriation has informed most musical traditions." That's a very, it's a very interesting statement, a very provocative, I think. Again, I've used anecdata three times, but I think it works here. I think a lot of people do have this image coming from, you know, movies like Amadeus, where you see Mozart toiling away in his apartment and, you know, pulling stuff out of his brain that creates, you know, this genius level classical music. But how does technology affect this condition? Does technology create more of an institution where you have the lone genius because we have these new tools that, as you mentioned, previously didn't exist or would require you to have access to a recording studio? So where is the lone genius today, and is it possible for that person to be there?
Well, one of the things things I try to argue is that this lone genius paradigm was never really a correct representation of reality anyway. It was a fitting idea during the Romantic era for many reasons, but just to sort of abbreviate a very large, long story, it was easier in the 19th century to think of authors as being isolated, atomic individuals who came up with great ideas on their own, even though that was never the case. I don't think very many people these days seriously subscribe to the lone genius paradigm. There's been kind of a general shift away from Romanticism and even modernism to postmodernism, which is a kind of branch of thought that views creativity as much more of a communal effort. If you look at some of the greatest novels of the 20th century, like Joyce's Ulysses, of course, he's riffing from all of the Western literature canon, virtually. And I think a lot of the public is pretty savvy to that. They know at this point that very respectable creative works in all disciplines very sort of robustly borrow from other works. So, to answer your question, where are the lone geniuses? Maybe they're up on the mountain somewhere, but I don't know where they are, because I think creativity happens in a community.
Yeah, and you know, I think you're right that the when we deal with the romantic vision of the artist, we forget that there's always a predecessor. And it's interesting because with something like Pro Tools, you know, as you mentioned, the person sitting at home is able to do something that for that individual may feel like he's being the lone genius or she's being the lone genius, when in fact there could be someone sitting in another room in another apartment somewhere, another house in the world doing the same thing. And of course, they're using previously existing works and often to create their new thing. So it's an interesting topic. And I think like many of the questions I've asked you today, I've really challenged you to answer a very complex question in a short amount of time. Let me touch on another point as we slowly wind up, and it was kind of something else that I found interesting. You talked about the right of publicity, and specifically you talked about the situations involving Bette Midler and Tom Waits. Tell us a little bit about the right of publicity and how these individuals, who both have, especially Tom Waits, very unique voices that anyone who's familiar with their work would identify them immediately, but how these individuals, in the interest of protecting their own reputations, challenged the use of their works in commercial settings.
Sure. The right of publicity is, it's not part of any sort of federal IP regime. It's not part of copyright. It's related to trademark, but it's not synonymous with it. And it operates under state laws. So obviously states like California and Tennessee that have very robust entertainment communities are going to have sort of more visible right of publicity laws. Now, what the right of publicity is the right for a performer to protect attributes that are part of his or her persona as an entertainer but aren't necessarily connected to content. So a perfect example in Tom Waits' case would be his voice, the fact that he has this really gravelly, intense, unmistakable voice. Once you've heard him, you know it's him. This is important to entertainers of Waits' ilk because they know that these sort of intangible, ineffable qualities are as much a part of their identity as the song lyrics that they have made famous. And Waits was able to successfully sue several entities for appropriating his performance identity. And the reason why is because Waits has always said, I don't do ads, I don't do commercials, I'm not going to try to hawk wares or commodities for the man. That's his statement as an artist. And so he's been able to convince judges that when people come along and try to imitate him, they're actually doing damage to his reputation as an artist. Bette Midler was able to do the same thing. I think that this is actually going to be a hotter area of IP litigation in the future because the technologies are such that samplers are actually becoming passé, and we can now train synthesizers and computers to imitate entertainers' voices and styles without actually sampling them. So the sort of traditional routes of prosecuting people through copyright law will perhaps become less relevant. So that's kind of what I'm keeping my eye on in the future.
The right of publicity, and again, it's one of those areas that kind of again touches on the commercial aspects of this, and I guess it leads into another area that I wanted to explore, which is generally so far the reaction to your book. I mean, your book, like I said, is exceedingly readable for people who are not attorneys and for people who are just interested in learning about this fascinating area, and obviously your background in music and your experience and knowledge base in that area informs a very complicated area. What has been the reaction to your book? Have people changed their minds? Do you have any notion that people are reading it and rethinking the issues? What do you see so far?
What I've seen has actually been pretty exciting. I've seen people get mildly angry about it, but angry to the point where they start to question assumptions they might have had. They might initially disagree with me and say, "Oh, well, I think sampling is wrong, it's theft." But then what I try to encourage people to do who've read the book is to talk about the differences and the similarities between, say, science and music. You wouldn't ever expect a scientist to pay a licensing fee for using Einstein's theory of relativity, right? Obviously not. When I try to ask these same questions about music, people have a kind of a knee-jerk reaction, well, of course they should have to pay. But then upon further reflection, I think I'm starting to make a point that there's more at stake here than just making a quick buck. We have to make sure that creativity is permanently encouraged in this country. If the book is able to start a debate, I'll be very happy.
Yeah, of course. And is there anything happening on the legislative level to address this stuff? I know that there have been bills kicking around and starting that focus on fair use issues, but do you have any sense of where this is going from a legislative standpoint?
Well, there are several groups involved that are kind of trying to shake things up at a slow level. The Future of Music Coalition is very slowly trying to work on Congress to consider a sort of compulsory licensing system for sampling. That's very early in the works. I'm not holding my breath yet. It may take a lot of work to get that through, but that would be icing on the cake for me if we could get to the point where we could adopt that sort of licensing strategy for sampling.
And the compulsory license, again, for those, is just briefly, if you could identify how that would solve the problem or at least help to rectify it.
Sure. We currently have a compulsory licensing system for compositions, which allows anyone to cover a song. So that's why, for instance, Richard Cheese could cover the Guns N' Roses song. He or his publisher just had to pay a nominal fee to the songwriting organization that owns Welcome to the Jungle. Currently, sampling doesn't have any such system, which means if you borrow someone else's recording, you have to gain permission first, and that permission is not guaranteed. If the permission is granted, the owner of the song, the sound recording, can charge any fee, can name any fee. And that's sort of the major problem I identify in my book, is that sampling is kind of an auction system right now where the person can set his price at any level and the musician just has to pony up or else not use it. If we had a compulsory licensing system for sampling, we would ensure that people do get paid, but we would also ensure that we have kind of a continuing, vibrant community of people who are sampling and who don't have to pay through the nose to do it.
I'm actually pleased and a little surprised to hear you as upbeat as you are about these issues, but it's good to hear. In the remaining few minutes, just a couple more quick things. On page 111 in your chapter, your title, The Shadow of the Law, you quote Sebald's masterpiece, Austerlitz, where, and I'm gonna read the quote that you quote from the book. There's a great example of fair use. So the quote here is, as you say, talking about a recently built Bibliothèque Nationale is an edifice whose architecture discourages, if not renders impossible, the free flow of knowledge. And the quote from Sebald is, "We begin a long whispered conversation in the Haute Jardin reading room, which was gradually emptying now, about the dissolution in line with the inexorable spread of processed data of our capacity to remember, and about the collapse," and my French is wonderful, l'effondrement of the Bibliothèque Nationale, which is already underway. The new library building, which in both its entire layout and its near ludicrous internal regulation seeks to exclude the reader as a potential enemy, might be described, ellipses, as the official manifestation of the increasingly importunate urge to break with everything which still has some living connection to the past. Wow. And, you know, it's a wonderful book as well. And I kind of wanted to, before I kind of close by asking you how people can get the book and reach you and that kind of stuff, is that stands pretty much in stark contrast with what you're suggesting might be happening in the future, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I don't want to be melodramatic. Sebald was talking very specifically about the French government's attempts to obscure what happened during the Vichy regime in World War II, and I'm not accusing our IP regime of doing anything so villainous, but
yeah, and I would not want to suggest that I didn't take that from your book either.
Okay,
and
good.
Yeah, so I don't especially since it's on the radio and on podcasts, I'll make that absolutely clear that
sure.
I didn't take that as the theme of your book either, but I think as kind of a very illustrative way to begin the discussion.
Yeah, it's a paradox of the internet culture that we're living in, right? The fact that we have greater access than ever before to data streams and to information, but perhaps precisely because we have this greater access, we're actually remembering less. The access is, of course, alarming content providers who justifiably want to ensure that they have revenue streams. You know, they have to stay in business. They have to continue to exist. But what the internet is doing is simultaneously giving us an overload, a surfeit of information, and also sort of undermining the ways in which brick-and-mortar businesses used to function and used to earn their living. So as a result, we could, if we are not careful as a society, get into a position where we could forget all of this information, even though we have it literally at our fingertips. To have access to information but not to be allowed to do anything with it is tantamount to not having the information, period. So I do feel that there's a good parallel between the Austerlitz quote and what we could do if we handle this in the wrong way.
Well, I think that warning and the fact that we do have ways to potentially address this problem is a good way to close the interview. I want to, of course, close by asking you the obvious question, which is for those people that want to get the book, I'm sure they can get it on Amazon. Are there any other ways to get the book, and how can, if anyone wants to reach out to you, is there a way to do that?
Sure. Any finer bookseller will do. In the L.A. area, I can talk about the independents there. Dutton's is a great place to buy books. In Beverly Hills or Brentwood, of course, Amazon, any place online. I can be reached via email at jtdemers@usc.edu, and I'm on the USC webpage, too.
Terrific. Well, Professor Joanna Demers, thank you so much for coming on today to discuss your book. Obviously, this is one of those many topics that we could do another hour or two and of course, we'd have to continue to have me engineering the program properly, which is always a challenge. But I want to thank you for taking the time today to come on today and discuss your terrific book, Steal This Music, How Intellectual Property Law Affects Music Creativity.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The Beastie Boys there doing a remote control. Hip-hop and the Beasties and so many other groups engage in this transformative work that I thought would be an appropriate way to close the show, because we kind of ran the gamut a little bit between hip-hop and jazz and the interesting lounge music of Richard Cheese. I want to thank Professor Demers again for coming on today to have this discussion and really discuss this issue, which is obviously only continuing to become an issue for more and more people, and only continuing to be a area that needs to be explored. As Professor Demers pointed out, there are a number of ways for people to get involved in this issue, but I think first and foremost, taking a look at this book, or at least familiarizing yourself with these issues, would be a good first step to see just how the law is impacting us today, and so I commend the book. Hearsay Culture runs from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Wednesdays. This show, which should be airing on June 21st, will continue the run of discussions that I've had on these issues. Coming up in the next few weeks are my colleague David Olson, CIS resident fellow, who will be discussing patent law and some other issues that touch on technology. And then further down the road, I'm scheduling Colin Rule from eBay, who will be coming on to discuss online dispute resolution, kind of a very interesting, challenging area, both from a technology standpoint, but also from a human standpoint of how to deal with these conflicts, which happen daily and perhaps hourly in the world of online auctions. I'm also looking forward to interviewing Frederick Herman, who's the New Jersey Election Law Enforcement Commission director, who will be coming on to discuss technology issues in the world of campaign finance reform and campaign finance enforcement. As always, you can learn more not only about this show, but about the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School by going to the webpage for CIS, which is cyberlaw.stanford.edu. There you'll be able to learn about the cases that the center is working on, along with scholarship and all of the great people who are affiliated with the center, both on a residential level and a non-residential level. So I encourage you to check that webpage out. And otherwise, I want to thank you again for listening today. My name again is Dave Levine. You've been listening to Hearsay Culture, and I'll look forward to talking to you next week.